session number 23216 Reel 3.
Colonel Corbould, Reel 3. I was asking you what the effective range of the 6-pounder anti-tank gun.
Well, I would say it'd be no more than 1,000 yards. I haven't thought anything. I didn't think the shell would have gone that much further.
What sort of targets did they put up for you to engage with this weapon at Lyd?
Moving targets.
Moving targets?
Yeah, yes, yes. And left to right, and you had to give out the orders and the set and the other.
Yeah. Were these in the shape of tanks, or were they silhouettes?
They were silhouettes. Cardboard things being, wooden things being taken across. You know. Yeah.
How many rounds a minute do you think you get off with one of these 6-pounders?
Great heavens above, Nigel. It's a long time ago. Let me think now. A minute?
Yes, rounds per minute is a...
I shouldn't think more than about 3 or 4. Because it was a question of having to unload and stuff the thing up again.
Yes.
And it was a very primitive anti-tank weapon, really. We didn't get onto 17-pounders, but I got to North Africa and did the course there. And of course, the 17-pounder lasted a long time.
Yeah. Well, the 32-pounder was planned. I think they found it was too cumbersome to actually put into the field.
Yes,
17-pounder was big enough to...
And it required, I mean, the chaps were pretty heavily built fellows who would heave it around.
Yes. Could you manhandle the 6-pounder easily?
Oh, much easier than a 17-pounder, obviously, yes. It was quite easy to handle. It was fairly small. It was lower on the ground. It didn't have a very big shield, like the 17-pounder. Mm. Yes, it was quite easy to manhandle the 6-pounder.
So from the tactical point of view, it would have some advantages.
Oh, very much so, yes. Mm. But of course, from the actual length of the range, that wasn't quite so good.
And the impact on the target.
And the impact on the target, yes. Mm. There was only one worse thing than that. We haven't mentioned one weapon called the Boy's Anti-Tank Rifle, which was absolutely, totally useless. It had a most enormous bullet and a kick like three mules. Several chaps had their shoulders dislocated firing it.
Had you actually used it yourself?
Oh, I had, yes, on the range. But thank God we never actually had it in action, because it was totally, I mean, the round would bounce off of a tank like a ping-pong ball.
They have told me it's very useful against motorcyclists and horses.
Yes, I think they're probably right, yes. Yes, or a well-dug-in position.
Yes.
If you shot a round off there into a cave or something like that, it would have great effect, yes.
It's really ricochet rather well, wouldn't it? Yes.
My goodness, yes. Yes.
Well, how did your guardsmen get on with the 6-pounder? Did they handle it?
Oh, they handled it perfectly well, yes.
Did they have confidence in it?
Yes, they did. Oh, yes, they did. And of course, by this time, we were learning more about tanks.
Yes.
And how dangerous they were on the battlefield. Mm. Therefore, they felt they were doing a damn good job firing at a tank, and they fired to kill.
How many guns did you have in the platoon?
I had 4, I think it was. Mm. Yes, 4 to the platoon. It may have been 6.
I mean, while you were in this role, were you ever actually brigaded with?
Yes, we were. We were in 6th Battalion Coldstream. We were brigaded in the 33rd Guards Brigade. Headquarters were at Pinner, commanded by a man called Brigadier Jefferson of the Welsh Guards. And we had the other two battalions were the 3rd Battalion Welsh Guards and the 3rd Battalion Irish Guards. Mm. And we formed the 33rd Guards Brigade. And then we used to exercise and train as a brigade.
Now that's quite a step up from what you've been doing earlier, isn't it?
Oh, yes, great step up. Yeah.
Very considerable.
I've got a very much wider picture.
Yes.
And on one particular occasion, I got a very wide picture because I was having to give out orders for a platoon attack, and the brigade commander was there. And next day I was sent for by the commanding officer, who said the brigade commander wants you to go and be the liaison officer of the brigade headquarters for the 6th Battalion Coldstream Guards. So I went off, because in that job I was even a motorcycle, and I motorcycled around between the three battalions, and I learnt a great deal.
What sort of things did you learn then? What were the lessons?
Well, I mean, what I saw was how, I mean, three battalions actually operate within a brigade group. Yeah. And on one occasion I had to motorcycle down to a unit of the Guards Armour Division on Salisbury Plain. And that was a great eye-opener, seeing how the tanks were going.
Was this the first time you'd seen armour on
mass? Yes, it was, yes. Then, of course, subsequently, as we'll come on to later on, as we were in the 6th Armoured Division in Italy.
You'd already had some experience with the carriers, though, I think you mentioned.
Yes, very little. It was just part of, a carrier, 2 or 3 days we did, as part of the young officers' course.
Just learning to drive them.
Learning to drive them, a slight bit about maintenance. Their value as a tactical weapon with Bren guns on them. Being able to fire while your movement was taking place. It wasn't very accurate. It didn't have any stabilizers.
What do you think of the Bren carrier? Do you think it was a useful...
At that time, it probably did. It was a little bit of an advance. But, of course, there being no stabilizer, you had very inaccurate fire coming from it, really.
They had a reputation for turning over on the ground.
Very much so. Very much so, indeed, yes. And sometimes the brakes went awfully good. I mean, one of our... Much later on in the... Was it later on in the war? No. It was in the 6th Battalion, I think. Renton Fontana, a poor man, was standing by a tree, and a carrier was coming towards him. The chap put the brake on and put it into reverse, and the brake didn't work, and he was crushed against the tree. He wasn't killed, but he was very badly injured.
Mm. They also had an administrative function, didn't they? Bringing up ammunition under fire.
Yes, they did.
Casualties.
Yes, they did. Yes. And putting carriers on the back on a stretcher, yes. And like that. Oh, they had their value, yes.
Mm.
But we didn't have them in Italy, I'm sure.
Mm. Again, did the Guardsmen take to them? Were they adaptable?
Oh, yes. Yeah, they liked them, yes. Mm. Oh, they took to them, yes, certainly. It was a sort of a mobile, as it were, instrument, you know, within the battalion, which is, we were so used to going on our feet.
Yes.
It's so nice to have something that you could move.
I was going to ask you about that, because you discussed doing a lot of route marching, which is obviously good for mobility and for fitness, but... the army was beginning to rely more upon motor transport on the three tonners and so on.
Yes.
Were you becoming accustomed to motorised movement?
And not very much until I got to Italy, really. And of course in North Africa when we were rehearsing in Italy.
Yes.
And that's when I got really used to movement. I mean, the war was getting more and more mobile month by month almost.
Indeed.
And look at the desert, for example.
Yes. Well, it was all movement.
All movement. Yes.
You mentioned being at 33rd Guards Brigade headquarters. Who was in the headquarters and how was it set up?
It was an ordnance brigade. We had a brigade major, a DAQMG, a staff captain. You had an umpire officer who was the chief umpire for the brigade, Jock Burns of the Scots Guards. We had a motor transport officer, two other liaison officers, one for the mix, one for the Welsh Guards. And that was about it.
So it sounds a rather small grouping, actually.
Quite a small group of officers, yes.
A tactical headquarters rather than a main headquarters.
Correct, yes. But it was adequate for that particular phase of the war.
How did the brigadier conduct his business within the headquarters? Did he have a normal routine of having morning prayers and other conferences, or did he do things on an ad hoc basis?
He had he was a very methodical man, indeed. He did, in fact, have morning prayers, yes. And then he'd send for us, the liaison officers, in rather the same way that Field Marshal Montgomery did much later on in the war with his liaison officers.
The directed telescopes.
That's right. Yeah. And we had to come back and report to him in detail what was going on, and indeed give detailed orders to our commanding officer.
So you were effectively in the same sort of role as the 18th century aide-de-camp.
That's right. Galloper, yes.
Except you were a revver.
On a mattress motorcycle.
Did you ever fall off the motorcycle?
Oh, yes, I did, yes. I was going one day from brigade headquarters to the 6th Battalion, and I got outside Bentley Priory, headquarters fighting command, and a car was going in there, and unfortunately, the WAF driver, with some air marshal in the back, put a hand out and turned all in one, and I was about to overtake. So I finished up in the railings. What I said to the WAF officer, WAF driver, I will not say.
Did the air marshal say anything?
No, he just looked there. And I said, it is rather extraordinary what happened to him. No.
You mentioned this brigade exercise. What was that, the form of exercise? What evolutions and manoeuvres were you practising on that occasion?
Well, we had to sort of take over battalions in the line, and particularly at night, because it's a very difficult operation indeed.
Reliefs, yes.
And relief in the line with a battalion, as you know, is a very tricky form. That's the first time I'd come across such huge manoeuvres and such huge operations of war. So and I wasn't very well. I wasn't very well briefed in the matter. Really.
How long did that exercise go on for when you were?
Well, the biggest exercise we had was exercise Python, which in fact was a home forces exercise,
yes.
Which went on about a week or 10 days, yes. And that was directed by the great Allenbrook.
What did that consist of? What did you do during?
We went up into Buckinghamshire and Hertfordshire and moved as a battalion.
Yes,
it was really an exercise of movement to get people moving.
So this was staff work then.
Yes. And ending up with a huge battalion attack.
How was that attack conducted? Was it two companies up and two back, or...?
That sort of thing, yes.
Was there an emphasis on flanking movements?
I can't say there was an emphasis, but obviously flanking movements came into it. But yes, I mean, we did do flanking movements, yes.
And when you're talking about brigade group, obviously you have the three guards battalions. What else was in the brigade group? What else was on the Orbat?
We had, I think we had RASC, of course.
Yes.
We had signals.
Yes.
I don't remember any gunners.
That's odd. I would expect you to have gunners if you were in a brigade group.
I would have thought so. Perhaps I'm using the wrong expression, brigade group.
Yes.
I think it was headquarters 33rd Guards Brigade, finished, not group.
Ah, yes.
I don't remember any gunners at all, but we had obviously ancillary arms, like engineers, RASC, and signals, particularly the signals.
I mean, one would expect if you're doing something on a brigade scale with battalions making formal attacks that you would at least have a notional artillery support, if not something...
I would think so. I can't remember it at all.
Yeah.
It's a long time ago, Nigel.
Oh, yes, but you can remember such things, you know,
well,
further than that. So you've got this big exercise Python up in the home counties north of London. Do you remember going on any other really big schemes before you went abroad?
That was the biggest scheme.
Mm.
That was the biggest scheme, which I was very interested to read about in the Allenbrook Diaries.
Yes.
He laid great importance to it because he was judging not only brigadiers, but he was, I think, going for higher command as well.
Well, it has to be corps level, doesn't it, if you're going to be potential divisional commanders.
Oh, yes, very much so.
Otherwise, it's not any sort of test.
You ought to read the Allenbrook Diaries. Are you reading them now, or have you read them? Well, you'll get a very good insight into the answers to some of the questions you're asking me from the great man himself.
But it's always good to have every question considered from more than one point of view.
But mine's a very lowly point of view indeed.
Well, at this stage, perhaps. Your next move then up to the 2nd Battalion, where were they when you joined them?
I joined at Bone on the coast of Algeria.
And how did you get out to them?
We went up by sea on the Johan van Bon Aldenveld, which was a Dutch ship turned into a troop ship. And we were all arms together. I mean, there were Coldstream detachments, there were other guards detachments, there was all arms of the army on the ship.
How many men were there in your draft?
Dear. I don't like to answer that question. I just don't know at all.
But it was a draft of Coldstream guards.
Yes.
Was it a mixed of officers and men?
Oh, yes. Very much so, yes.
What conditions like on the ship?
Not bad. We were crowded together. I think we had six in our cabin. Was it four? Four in our cabin. Yes, it was all quite... It nearly drove us mad. In the cabin next door, we had Humphrey Littleton with his bloody trumpet. It nearly drove us mad.
Was he practicing?
Yes. He was a good grenadier.
How long did it take, this trumpeting voyage?
We left on the 10th Addison Road underground station. We went up by train to Liverpool. Then we had to go up into Scotland. I can't think why. All through, I suppose, with submarines and God knows what.
Mm-hmm.
And we eventually arrived in Algiers about 10 or 12 days later.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went into a thing called the Infantry Reinforcement Training Depot outside Algiers, which was extraordinarily uncomfortable. Then, of course, we all got jippy tummy.
Why was it so uncomfortable? What?
Well, the food wasn't good, and we were living in sort of fairly crowded tents.
When you sailed out, did you go as part of a convoy?
Yes. But we went through past Gibraltar. Well, yes, we didn't have to go right the way down and back again. You know.
Was it a large convoy? Do you have any idea of the scale?
I think it was, yes. We didn't have any submarine scales. I do remember that. Mm. Or aircraft scales.
Mm. Was it escorted?
It was being definitely escorted, yes, yes.
Do you have any idea about the sort of strength of the escort?
No idea at all. No idea at all.
Was it possible to do any sort of training while you were on route?
Well, mainly fitness training, yes. Yeah. It was pretty crowded. Mm. We didn't fire our weapons at any targets on the... Obviously, I think we wouldn't have been wise with all the other ships in the convoy.
Yes.
But we did a lot of fitness training and lectured to the chaps, too, on the current affairs situation. There was another thing, of course, we were always having current affairs thrust down our throats.
Did you find that the guards were keenly interested in current affairs?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, they were, yes. I'd like to know what's going on. I don't remember seeing very much of newspapers in those days. Mm. And of course, they were being published, but I mean, one's not so used to reading a newspaper now, which we didn't, of course, do in those days, but we did keep ourselves abreast with what was going on. We had to.
Could you get news from the BBC?
Oh, yes, yes. You see, and also we were having this thing thrust on our throat the whole time, ABCA, the Army Bureau of Current Affairs. Mm. It was a bit of a pain in the backside.
Did you have to do any of these lectures yourself?
Oh, yes. Very much
so. Can you remember anything that you had to lecture about?
Well, all that was going on at that particular time. Mm. And I know one used to read sometimes from newspapers and so on. But if it was a lecture to be given of other people there, I normally wasn't asked to do it because they think that I've stuttered too much.
What was your first impression of North Africa when you got to Algiers and landed?
Well, it was very pleasant indeed. It was very peaceful, really. After all, it was the African campaign had ended, and they were all getting ready for the invasion of Sicily, which didn't concern us. Having gone to Beaune, we went to Constantine, where we were quartered beside the 13 Welsh Guards in a huge, huge wood. And there we stayed until we left we had to go down to Carthage for Christmas 1943 to look after Churchill and Roosevelt. We looked after them for about a week or 10 days. And then we went off to Italy after that.
Did you have anything to do with the local population in Algeria while you were there?
Not much, no. No.
Did you see anything of the French?
No, we didn't see anything. Well, we saw them, but we didn't have much to do with them at all. We never went to their mess, and they didn't come to ours at all, no.
Sounds like you were rather self-contained.
We were. We were very much... We were in the First Guards Brigade. We were very much sort of together.
Were you able to do any large-scale collective training?
Well, I went and did a course. I went and did a course at a place called Ain Samara, which was a platoon commander's course in Algeria. And that was the School of Infantry in Africa at that time.
Were they teaching you things that were different to those you had already learned?
Well, more advanced, yes.
More advanced. In what way are they more
Well,
advanced?
I mean, we were getting more of the battalion view of things. Ah. And the brigade view of things,
yes.
And on exercises like acutes and so on, it was on that bit up to that level. So we were getting a much broader view of what was going on.
Was there any difference in the essential principles or style of tactics in that school at Ain Samara?
Well, I would have hoped to have seen people who had actually been in action in North Africa, but I don't remember seeing an instructor there who'd done anything in the North African campaign, which was a great pity. A lot of it was repetition. A lot of it was.
One might imagine that having fought either across the desert or in the terrain in Algeria and Tunisia, they might have had somewhat different emphases.
Well, I would have. You see, I don't remember. I don't remember the commandant.
Yes.
And I was very careful here because he was a green jacket. I hope to get involved in that. But I don't remember him giving us a lecture at all. Mm. I suppose it was a chief instructor, but yes. Who he was, I don't quite know. Mm. It didn't really teach me very much, quite frankly. And I was thankful to get back to the battalion. Mm. Also, because I did another anti-tank course out there too.
Was that when you met the 17-pounder?
That's when I met the 17-pounder for the first time, yes, yes.
What sort of range would the 17-pounder go out to?
I suppose they went up to what? 2,000 or 3,000 yards?
Were they accurate out to extreme range?
They weren't too bad, actually, the 17-pounder. It's a hell of a bang, of course. And, of course, they required much more physical effort to manhandle them.
Presumably, they would also have a slower rate of fire.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Very much so.
And they'd have a bigger profile.
Oh, yes. Very much so. It's a different kettle of fish.
How did you move them? I'm presuming they weren't on a portee.
They had a vehicle of some sort. I know what it was. You know, I've got an idea. We had carriers that towed them at one stage. I think so.
How did the guardsmen take to this change of...
The guardsmen are simply wonderful people. They change very quickly indeed. They will change any particular situation. They're very good at that sort of thing, as they are today, too. Mm. They're wonderful.
At this infantry school in Samara, you mentioned having lectures and so on. Did you do much in the way of practical exercises there, or was it mainly theoretical?
It was mainly theoretical. We did tute after tute after tute.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think we didn't do it much field training, actual field training as such, because there weren't the troops available. They were all sort of... I remember one day we had a demonstration when the 10th Battalion of the Parachute Regiment, which distinguished itself as Arnhem, the subsequent day, they did a dawn drop for us, which we were very impressed indeed.
That must have been a spectacular sight.
It was a most spectacular sight, yes. And little did I know that one day I would be joining that august throng.
You mentioned that you had stomach trouble while you were in Algeria.
Mm.
Were there any other hazards to health that you had to be aware of?
Yes, we all had this mepocrine, which turned your eyeballs yellow and the palms of your hand. You look very jaundiced indeed. Indeed, I had jaundice when I was in North Africa and lost an enormous amount of weight. But didn't I be able to carry on my duties?
Mm. Do you have any idea of how you picked that up?
I have no idea how I picked it up, otherwise it was inherent in what was going on. Quite a lot of other people caught jaundice too. Mm. I was put into hospital for a few days and fed on tinned salmon and boiled potatoes only.
It's a very peculiar sort of diet.
it cured me. I was
it did the trick for you then.
I wasn't allowed to have any fatty food or anything like that. The hospital was very good indeed, also in Samara. Mm.
What could you do for recreation in North Africa?
Well, mainly sort of football and that type of thing, yes. And we used to do a lot of running around too, organised battalion runs. The main thing was to keep people absolutely fit.
Yes.
Both mentally and physically. That was terribly important. And also to keep the morale of the men up too. It required going to one's platoon even more frequently than before.
Why was that? Was morale
there was a certain amount of time where they had very much on their own.
Yes.
And of course they wanted to sit down and write to their families. And of course this was the other thing. We had to vet all their letters too, which was a very time-consuming pastime. And one felt I was prying into people's private lives a good deal, particularly when one's platoon son would say, well, here's my letter to my wife, sir, you know. And I wouldn't divulge anything of that at all, but I didn't like doing that, but one had to do it.
Mm.
But one didn't. It was rather like, I suppose, in the Roman Catholic Church, the father confessor didn't say anything at all.
Incidentally,
I am not a Roman Catholic.
Did Mail come back?
Oh, yes. Mail came back. The most amazing thing happened in Constantine one day. One of my chaps in my platoon had a letter at 4 o'clock that afternoon, and the postmark was Victoria Station that morning. Absolutely unbelievable. And of course, morale went soaring to the heights.
That must have come out by air then.
I must have done, yes. But it was quite amazing. That's one of those postal miracles.
Absolutely.
But it did the chap's morale a power of good.
When did you first become aware that you were going to go to Italy? How did that news get to you?
Well, after the Sicilian campaign had gone down, we knew we were the next for it.
Yes.
And then, of course, Salerno took place, where our third battalion distinguished itself in a very big way indeed. And we won a Victoria Cross there with the third battalion. And then we were put in just north of Naples, just before the crossing of the Garigliano. And there was a most enormous battle at a place called Monte Ornito, which is one of our battle honours today, which was a very nasty battle indeed.
How did
that was the first battle we had in Italy.
Yes. How did you get to Italy?
On a ship going over, a naval ship, going over from Philippeville. We embarked at Philippeville. And landed at Naples. The engines were done. It was done at night. Mm. And we slept in the open deck. I can remember that. Then we marched from Naples to... I can't remember the name of the place now.
How did you get there? Was this a march on foot? Or was
march on foot. From Naples to the next place, yes.
And did you know exactly where you were going when you landed near Naples?
Well, we hadn't been briefed for Ornito or anything that. No. That didn't happen until we actually landed.
So you landed, you marched somewhere near Naples, and what happened to you when you got there? Was this a transit area you were in?
That sort of thing. Then we were briefed then for Ornito, yes.
Do you remember what was in the briefing, what they told you about the situation?
Well, we were told that they were in profusion up on top of this hill.
Yes.
And we were told, of course, that the weather was simply appalling, and we were told it was going to be very tough fighting indeed. And it was hand-to-hand. It was a very unpleasant situation indeed.
How did you get up to the area of the Garigliano? Was that by motor transport?
I'll have to refer to my book, I think. I won't do it just now. It takes some time to find, but I can look this up for you.
Yes.
And be more... I didn't quite know we were going to be going back as far as this.
Mm. And you were still a platoon commander at that stage?
Oh, yes, very much so. I didn't reach the dizzy heights of captain, company, second in command until after the fall of Rome.
And were you by the stage a full lieutenant or
Yes. Yeah. No, I was just a subaltern then, yes.
Subaltern.
Yes. In fact, I became a subaltern when I was with the 6th Battalion.
Ah. Did that involve any sort of formal procedure,
no.
Going up a rank? It was just a matter of senior.
Well, I became a subaltern when I went as liaison officer to the 33rd Guards Brigade.
Oh.
And so I proudly put up another star.
That way it must have made a difference.
It made all the difference, I felt rather good.
Yes. What was your first impression of Italy when you arrived and got off the ship?
Well, it was February 1943. 43? 44. February 44. And Naples was in an appalling state. And it was dirty, filthy. It was a horrible morning. It was very dull, raining. Mm. We didn't form a very good impression of it, no. You know, the Bay of Naples was one of the 7 wonders of the world. That didn't really come into our minds at all, I can assure you.
What sort of mood were the guardsmen in now that they were finally going forward into
excellent
operation?
Excellent. Great form. And raring to go. I have no complaints about the guardsmen at all at any time during my service. Mm. They were absolutely superb, and they were worth every minute one spent with them.
So
they relied upon them on a good deal, of course.
Yes. Well, it's been said a platoon commander has to be a mother and father.
So that is true, yes. And I felt like that too.
Mm.
And because I knew them so well, and having been in touch with their parents and wives and so on and so forth.
Were many of them married?
Not many. No, not many. The younger ones certainly were not.
Mm. You arrived in Naples and you went to a transit camp. And what happened at the transit?
Well, no, it wasn't actually a camp. It was an area.
It wasn't
a camp.
Yes.
What was it called? It was San Petito. That was later on. It'll come to me as soon as I'm gone, I know.
Yes.
But it was a concentration area for the battalion.
Yes. And you got there on foot?
Again, we must have had some transport somewhere.
Yes.
We must have done.
Quite a long way from Naples up to the Garigliano.
Yes. No, we must have had transport. We marched a good deal for the vehicles, I think.
Yes.
Then we were put into vehicles and went the rest of the way. Oh, it'll come to me. I can see the place clearly in my mind's eye. Just can't put a name to it. Anyhow, and from there, it was Ornito.
Do you remember what you were told about the enemy before you went into the attack?